Hi, everybody.
Hi.
It's great to be back. I was able to see in the dark and also drive.
Oh, you drove?
I drove myself.
Oh, yay. With Miriam. Oh, she was supposed to be driving, I think.
Miriam was a witness. So, when we first started talking about divvying up the chapters, I said to Emily, I really want to do this chapter. Because it sounds so interesting. And I read the chapter. Read the chapter again.
Yeah.
And then I had to take notes. Then I had to figure out what my notes said. So, let's start by, for those of you who have read the chapter, what was it like? What are your impressions? What do you think?
This is chapter 8.
Chapter 8. Which is karma as a possible foundation for ethics.
It was interesting,
yes. So was Bob Mueller's report today, but that was also interesting.
We had an interesting talk last time, and I think it merges, you know, perfectly with this, in that the author, I don't know.
Trollig
Rinpoche. That's Trollig. He gave a non-theistic foundation, and I think it phases in beautifully with ethics and the dynamics of karma. In that the possibilities, the way I saw it is,
yes,
the possibilities are infinite for the positive ways of deciding. It's not a rigorous yes, no, or four or five options. It's really an infinite number because it depends upon the individual's own background, set of experiences. And but I have a curious note in from mathematics on stuff like this.
Okay.
And I had a math professor who always got a kick out of saying, well, here's a set of equations. It was, you know, a certain course. And he said, and you know, in this set of equations, there's an infinite number of correct answers. And so it sounds like, he said, but you know what? Most of you are going to go home and wallow in the infinite number of wrong answers. So I took that as an ethical issue too, because neurosis, I guess, is wallowing in the negative possibilities, or the unproductive, or the non-harmonious ones with karma, and the ethical ones really. In his framework of dynamics of karma, a huge variation of positive.
I'm glad you read this chapter with great interest and passion. That's great.
I found sort of, I still have this issue when he gets very philosophical and quotes people. I'm like, and I finally realized, like, it got me so agitated that I could just go to the next paragraph.
Okay.
And skip a paragraph. I could read some of the other stuff, which was really, you know, I felt really...
That's called What to Refrain From.
Right.
Paragraphs that piss you off.
Right, okay. Right. Well, then I was kind of reading it when I was really pissed off about something else, so it helped, but... I mean, I just felt like the last part of the chapter, I liked the way he says, sort of taking it from not worrying so much about bad karma and trying to create good karma, like just go that way instead of always saying this is bad and that's bad. Just how can we change our thoughts so we're working in a positive direction?
Yes.
Good. It did, you know, on Lisa's point, it made me wonder, why do we... You know, it said that negativity is so habit-forming, but yet it seems like so much more difficult to focus on developing positive habits. And I was wondering why...
I have also noticed that in my life.
Yes, exactly. You know, but why?
But why?
Yeah.
Excellent.
I actually have an answer.
Excellent. That's even better. Better than excellence.
It's the answer of evolutionary biologists and evolutionary psychologists, which is that for survival, it's much more important to remember where the tiger is that wants to eat you than, I don't know, the nice sunset that was just pretty or something like that. So, I mean, it's pretty, I think that makes sense. I mean, it's just, since everything we do is, I believe, is basically related to our survival, so it is more important to avoid the, whatever, the
bad stuff,
the lion, whatever. So I think that's why. It's part of our environment.
True. Yeah. And as human beings, we tie ourselves in knots through negativity.
No, I'm not.
When there's no survival at all.
Right. It's just, we make things that don't have to do with real survival feel like it is.
Yes, the part of their complexity. Mr. Levin.
Well, I had an impression of the relation of this chapter to the whole, which is, if you're going to stick your thumb into the issue of karma, whatever plum you pull out is the whole thing. You cannot pull out a piece. Once you get into it, you cannot pull out a little piece of it. For instance, if you, in this chapter, you pull out the issue of good karma, bad karma, and beyond karma, and immediately, where does beyond karma leave you? And now I'm losing it.
However, we don't have to talk about beyond karma tonight.
No, we don't. But if you start to talk about anything, it leads you into the realization that whatever you, wherever you're going,
there you,
you
are.
Can't do it unless you do the whole thing. There's no little bit. You can't get into it without doing the whole thing.
So what is his, why does he talk about ethical theory? Is he just showing off his philosophical chops?
Yeah, I think so. I found that interesting because I really haven't studied philosophy formally. I realize I probably have informally without realizing it. But I found it kind of interesting. It was like my first philosophy course.
Okay.
I guess he had to make his point that this is Christian philosophy, and this is, was an atheist, and I mean, just to put it in the perspective of the world, I think.
Oh, it's on his own. The foundation of ethics is a really interesting problem, because we are so confused as modern people. And the fact is that we all are, he says at some point, we are moral beings because of the kind of beings we are. We think in moral categories. We judge people. We judge ourselves. We think about the gap between who we are and who we'd like to be. We feel guilty. We feel remorseful sometimes. But we are also excuse-making creatures. Trolog Rinpoche talks about our propensity towards self-deception. And so his view is, let's look at foundations of ethics, because we all are ethical creatures. We all have standards of right and wrong, even if we don't follow them very well, according to our own estimate. That's the kind of people we are. So we start from who we are. And the contrast he was making with what you call theistic systems, in which there's some kind of a moral law, or sometimes it's philosophized as a natural law that's sort of brought down to us is the foundation of morality is outside of us. Or he contrasts that with the idea of the inalienable, God-given rights that all people are created equal and stuff like that, which is only justified because it's, quote, God created. Yet we all know that in us we have a sense of fairness and justice and mutuality. That's part of how we're constituted. So he says, why don't we look at ethics because we are ethical beings? And possibly the idea of karma actually can help us navigate this and make sense of it. So that's where he's starting from. And, you know, true confessions, I've studied this sort of stuff for, oh, since I was a freshman at Brandeis a few decades ago, when I read Kant's Foundation to the Metaphysics of Morals, which is still a great book.
A little judgment?
It is. And then I read Nietzsche's Genealogy of Morals and stuff like that, so I get very excited by this stuff. And lately...
I have to say, I took one philosophy course and I dropped out after 2 weeks. I really cannot understand this stuff. And it's really painful. It doesn't make any sense to me.
Okay. Okay.
I bet Roberta feels the same way too.
I'm speaking for the other half. There I am.
Michael?
Did you get excited about Augustine?
I got excited about Aristotle.
Well, okay.
And I'll tell you why.
I'm trying to have an open mind.
Remember how Trallog Rinpoche says, you know, it's about who we are. Ethics is about who we are. Aristotle said the same thing. Of course, Trallog Rinpoche doesn't say that. But Aristotle said, we are rational animals. We think. We can make choices. I bet your animals at home don't have anywhere near the range of choices that we do. We make ethical choices. We think about, we deliberate. Okay, that's what helps make us human. Secondly, he says, we are political animals, meaning we are members of community. And so he's going to look at ethics from who we are as interconnected socially. Roberta, you've been trying to say
I'm
something.
Like choking on this. So.
Don't choke.
No. I know we're capable of thinking, but I mean, I'm going with the excuse-making creatures because I think, you know, we decide what we like. Most of what we do is based on emotion. We think, well, I'm doing this because of all these highfalutin thoughts. And that's a bunch of crap, really.
Excellent. You're right.
We much more react and make our decisions, I think, based on emotion. What moves us or doesn't move us away or towards something. And then we make up a bunch of baloney about why we have reasoned this.
That's exactly the point. That's exactly the point I'm trying to make.
Good point.
You just said it. You said it much better than me. Here, you can read my handwriting. I'd give you my notes, but you can't read my handwriting.
No, I just have a nose for bullshit.
No, Roberta, you said that perfectly.
You processed it though in a way that made sense. I mean, you said something that actually is reflected in what Joseph's teaching, to which you may not, you know.
I didn't read the chapter.
Yeah, well, you don't know, but there's something.
You didn't have to read it.
Aristotle saying we are what we thought we knew. You know, that just, I never studied it.
And
there we go.
Now, I don't want to talk about Aristotle, but he does talk about the fact that we often know better and do worse. Okay? So that's part of the picture.
And we've done great.
Aren't we?
So many people are so...
How many of us do self-righteous anger.
One of my favorites.
How many of us, the slogans talk about, act with a twist? We think we're doing good for somebody, but we, you know, we're sort of looking over our shoulder. Who's looking at us? Okay?
So I wanted to say this sentence at the bottom of page 106.
I love it.
There is a place for the idea of rights and justice, but it cannot be the basis for morality. Mm-hmm. And then it says, we have seen what are rights for one group of people is a violation of the rights for another group. Mm-hmm. And what is justice for one is unjust. Is injustice for the other. So right away I thought about slavery.
Of course.
So wait a minute here. You know, is he saying there's no morality? He says the idea of rights and justice is not the basis for, cannot be the basis for morality. But how could you make a justification for slavery?
You can't.
People do. I mean, that's
how
they
people
got,
do.
They
do.
Did survive
of
for
course.
200 years,
yeah.
300, 250 years.
The problem, Emily.
All right, tell me.
It's a problem. This is a problem, okay? Because we all in our culture despise slavery, okay? I mean, all of us in this room, I should say, okay? There are people in different parts of the world and who may think differently. We also have to appreciate that that's the case for our culture now. Right. It hasn't been the case in the past. And the problem is that where does this idea of justice come from? And, you know, Thomas Jefferson, you know, God-given inalienable rights. Well, if you stop believing in God, where does this go? Dostoevsky.
I read that.
Okay.
Crime and Punishment. Yeah.
Okay. If there is no God, everything is permitted. From the Brothers Karamazov. Okay. That's the problem with basing morality on some kind of external theistic notion.
Okay.
That if you stop believing in the external entity that's giving it to you, then, quote, everything is permitted. Fortunately for Dostoevsky, his characters had to learn better, that their ethics, their sense of right and wrong have to come from within, just like Trolloc Rinpoche says. Now, back to you. You have uncovered perfectly the fact that we are excuse-making, self-deceiving, but highly intelligent and genuine creatures. Because sometimes we fool ourselves, but often we don't. How often does it happen to you that you're making some kind of excuse and sounds plausible and you know you're just full of shit? Okay? It happens to all of us. Sometimes we can con ourselves, sometimes we can't. That's our basic intelligence. That's our basic Buddha nature, you could call it.
I think we fool ourselves more often. I think so many people never get to the point of questioning themselves. I mean, they may once in a while.
Well said.
I used to have a shirt that said, had big bananas on it, and it said, more than 25% of human genes are the same as those of a banana.
Sure.
Get over yourself.
Yeah. Sure.
I think that, you know, people are so full of, I think it's an American thing too. I had friends from Europe who were just, you know, sort of appalled by, here I am, I'm so dynamic. It was a therapy thing. I mean, you know, oh, she's so dynamic, and I was never dynamic. I was shy.
Yes, we are in a celebrity culture. However, Trolloc Rinpoche says something that I find a little comforting, that people who are truly conscious, fully conscious of their intentions and the results of their actions, are Buddhas.
That was amazing.
The rest of us are confused. Okay? Do I hear any disagreement?
Can you say that again?
Yeah, say it again.
The rest of us are confused.
Before that.
Okay. That the individual who is fully aware of his or her intentions and the results of their actions is a Buddha, is completely enlightened.
Yeah. You're talking about in general, not a somebody that's...
Right, right. I'm not talking... Yeah.
So you're talking about their...
So that leaves the rest of us sentient beings as intelligent and stupid, as kind and selfish, as loving and closed-minded. Okay, we're all that. So this is where karma comes in. Because the idea of karma is really helpful to navigate these waters. And we shouldn't feel bad because we're sentient beings and we're not Buddhas. It should actually be liberating. Because we could appreciate our fellow sentient beings' confusion a whole lot more easily if we appreciate our own. But the question is, and this is where karma comes in, is how can we live the best life? How can our actions not be good or bad in some kind of a categorical thing, but of greater benefit, of less harm? How can we do that? That's where karma comes in. And we have to appreciate our human condition. How is it that we are self-deceived, that we screw up so easily, that we have so many mixed intentions, that we cover things over with a veneer of maybe sanctimony, that first of all, we're stuck in this body. Miriam.
For me, karma is the place of ripening or awakening, where you're given the opportunity to clear away the confusion. Because if something ripens or grows or comes back at you, which it does, you have the opportunity to temporarily or for a moment drop the self-deception. Mm-hmm. Because it's trying to teach you or show you something about the experience where maybe your vision was here. It's trying to do this.
If we can approach things with the right attitude and with less self-justification.
If we can't, it's going to keep doing it until it gets your attention.
Exactly. That's where I'm going next, just like what Roberta did. Yep. How do we get stuck is how we create karma, Janet.
Well, and I think that goes along with that is they say karma is action. You know, so if you recognize a deception and then you can just say, well, I'm not going to do anything or whatever. I'm too lazy to say anything or whatever. So therefore, you know, you have to do something to make the difference.
That's right. That's creating good karma.
Right.
That's right. And so how do we manage that transition from creating karma that gets us stuck in negativity, usually, that narrows our world, that makes us small-minded, and turn that into karma that interacts, that opens, that is receptive? And Trolog Rinpoche brings in a little bit of what's called Abhidharma, the fact that we project our worlds, we divvy up our worlds into what we like, what we don't like. We are constantly assessing things, how they relate to here, to central headquarters. And That's part of who we are. That's part of having a body. You know, Susan talked about, you know, we are built to survive. Well, damn right. We are built also to interact. We are social, we are mammals. We do dependency. And so part of our karma is we're born in situations in a world. And at one point, Trungpa Rinpoche talked about, well, you got on this train, you have to stay on this train. that we have to begin by appreciating the wealth that we already have. However, what we tend to do is cover things over, act in a sort of narrower way than we need to. Obviously, if we need to survive physically, we're going to do whatever it takes. We often, our intentions can be very small, and they're usually multiple. What happens, however, is our intention, our thoughts, he says, you know, as the Buddha said, who we are is a result of what we have thought. Mm-hmm. Our thoughts, which, as we know from our meditation, can be all over the place. Our intentions in the world can be all over the place. Our action in the world can be narrow because we don't understand what the hell we're doing. Therefore, if our actions are narrow, the repercussions will come back to us. A couple ways.
What does it mean actions are narrow?
Actions. Because when we act out of habit, when we act out of these patterns that we've set down for ourselves, it's like if all you have is a hammer, everything's a nail.
So we're in a rut.
We're in a rut.
We do the same.
You know, somebody pushes our buttons and we get pissed off. Mm-hmm. Or we feel hurt. Or we feel sorry for ourselves. And we all have these like one track behaviors. What happens is we're not dealing with reality. We're doing something fairly narrow, and maybe sometimes it works out, often it doesn't, because we're acting not according to what's necessary in a situation, we're acting according to habitual pattern. That comes back at us, because we do things that are unskillful or stupid, and we're in an interconnected world, and things come back. We also know that things come back to us sort of mentally. That if we... What happens if we, like, lie a lot? Like, all the time? Well, first of all...
Depends who we are.
It depends on who we are.
If we can reject...
No.
Reject
no.
Our lives.
He hasn't hit 10,000 yet. It's coming up.
10,000 lives?
Yeah.
Oh, come on. Wow. Years ago, 10,000.
No.
Just since he started.
Okay. By the way, ever notice that this is proof that we're moral beings, that when somebody appears to lack empathy or lack contrition or lack guilt, we often feel that person is handicapped, has a major, major problem dealing with reality if you don't have moral categories.
I heard on, I think, public radio one time that somebody counted how many lies we tell, how often we tell. And I think they must have been, you know, if it's not the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Like, you know, when you don't say to your boss, "Yeah, you're an idiot," you just say, "Uh-huh."
Yes, sir, how
that's
high?
A lie.
Yes.
Yeah. It's 138 times a day. And I thought that was really wonderful.
I don't think I say anything 138 times a day, let alone lie. Well, but
I mean, not the same one.
Okay. You know, well, okay. Now, that's something worth examining.
Yeah.
Because, okay, all right, we have to look at intention. Sometimes out of ignorance, sometimes out of not paying attention, sometimes out of protecting ourselves, sometimes out of not hurting someone.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we're cutting corners, sometimes we're actually helping somebody out in some way. But if we tend to, let's say, I'm just using lying as an example, or stealing as an example, or sexual misconduct as an example, it can perpetuate itself very easily. Also, what you project onto others is a karmic repercussion. If you lie, you don't trust people. If you steal things, you become miserly. You become like the dragon with the treasure in the cave. There is people who perpetuate negativity live unhappy lives. Some of us, when we're not getting really angry with them, some of us may decide to feel compassionate toward people who are so stuck, because we know that we all have that capacity. And so our karma is who we are, how we are now, how we perpetuate habitual pattern in terms of its self-perpetuating or bringing us into loops with each other that cause difficulty. And so what happens is we feel emptier and emptier. So these are basic things to refrain from. Okay. But what to cultivate? How do we get out of this? This sounds pretty bleak. How do we improve? How do we diminish habitual patterns that result in karma that causes unhappiness to ourselves or others? How do we create positive seeds, a positive environment for others and ourselves?
Well, it says basically,
read
something. Think happy thoughts.
Think happy thoughts.
Whistle a happy tune.
Whistle while you work, yes.
Right. Well, I like this. I mean, this is very proactive, and it's basically saying that you can sort of turn it around. You start thinking positively. You mentioned the spouse. If you're having a problem with a spouse, you know, caught in something, you start realizing and thinking what a nice person they are. So, you know, something like that. And then it keeps going on. It's sort of just to intentionally think positively and then do positive things, and then you form new habits. I mean, it makes sense.
Basic positive psychology.
Yeah.
It's been around for a while.
The other thing that I would add, and from the other book, because I haven't gotten too far in this one, was the importance of listening. And when I meditate, that's one of the words that I use. I find that I do best with just a few words.
Mm-hmm.
And when you listen to others rather than speaking, like in the other book, mm-hmm. it talks about when you're upset and you like a stone, sit
mm-hmm.
and listen rather than speaking and saying things that I might regret later. You know, I thought that was a really important one to go with. Mm-hmm.
And we all know how difficult that can be. Because sometimes we hear what we want to hear, or people tell us what they think we want to hear. We could do neurotic contracts all the time, especially with people who are like married to them and stuff.
I think one way that I have the pattern is to know myself. You know, I was thinking of what Roberta said about, you know, people who are all like, you know, pretentious and all that. And And what you said about that innate intelligence, and I think that's what makes you project. So everything that you know, there's a sort of a, you know, it may be suppressed, but you have an idea that you're the one who's the liar, and so you can't take your, you know, you're focused on the other person's lying or whatever it is that you have a feeling this is part of you. You know, I think it was you who said
it's very unsettling sometimes.
Everything that irritates you about other people is trying to tell you something about yourself.
Yeah. That could be a tough thing to look at.
Always our own faults that we can't stand.
Right.
But that's people who are judgmental. You don't seem arrogant, though. It's the arrogance of other people.
From the software perspective, I'm a software guy. So we are developing because of your social activity, you know, because of your Facebook, WhatsApp, whatever you do. So some of the companies, they identify you, what type of guy you are.
Company
is developing the software by which after 5 years, it's prediction that you will not prefer to talk to the person, other person.
That you will not be what? I'm sorry?
Any person will not prefer to talk to the other person.
Prefer.
He will prefer to talk to the software. So the reason behind, the software knows that what you are looking for.
Yeah.
Who you are.
That's the scary.
Knows that what interests you.
Uh-huh.
The software knows that what you will prefer to hear. You know? So you will prefer to talk to them than compared to the
So we have software that really replicates our samsaric selves.
So that it can teach us to talk to the computer instead of other people.
What does that say about the person who wrote the program?
On the basis of your activity, what you do, let us assume that you go to the Facebook, you like the whatever you like. So he knows that, okay, you are liking, let us suppose you want to go and like it. You like over the food. Somebody like over the sports. So you know that, okay, you like over the food, you like over the sports. So whenever you want to talk, they will talk about the sports. For you, they will talk about the food. They will talk about the something movie. So that's the way, you know. And why you talk with other people? So that you understand what you're expecting it.
So it's sort of, it's like what they used to say that they would teach young women.
Yeah.
When you go out on a date, find out what this person is interested in and talk about that.
Right.
Because it's not about you, it's about them. Yeah. Right? That was the kind of idea that That's
really depressing.
But that was true.
There's a part of that that's not, you don't have to see it so cynically. I mean, if somebody's just sort of socially awkward and they wonder why they're not connecting with people, it's like maybe you would ask them a little bit about themselves rather than talking about yourself.
No, but this was really like, you shouldn't talk about yourself. You should only... Even if you have no interest in the Red Sox, you should learn all about them so you can talk to this person about it. Because you should make sure that you are interested in what that person's interested in. But it wasn't reciprocal.
There's a very funny scene in a movie I'll tell you about later, but we're getting off track.
You know, it just says, you know, about 2 months ago there was this woman who had written about the algorithm that's Facebook users, you know. She said she had been, obviously Facebook realized that she was pregnant because of all the likes and all that. And then she had a stillborn baby, and Facebook kept sending all the messages to her about babies and baby clothes and what to do with them. And she said,
I'm going to tell you something.
So that's why human beings are still better than computers.
They're not, because I had a miscarriage of third pregnancy, and my stupid midwife, the midwife who's supposed to be so sensitive, didn't read the chart and died. I mean, it was just stopped. So people are pretty bad, too. I mean,
They wouldn't do it endlessly.
It's like, it's the same thing. Whatever.
Michael, then I'm going to read.
Well, one of the problems with Facebook is that it only has like. It doesn't have don't care or don't
care.
When you like it, there's the option that if you're sad, you're angry, you are very happy.
Facebook doesn't have a don't care. It doesn't have a don't like. And even the so-called unlike merely removes the like. It doesn't go into unlike. So it's an extremely biased system.
It's trying to give us positive thoughts.
So, Trollope Rinpoche emphasizes self-examination in this chapter. I was reminded of the Thomas Jefferson line, that's the ACLU motto, that eternal vigilance is the price of liberty.
That's a good
one. Yeah.
That's good.
So there's a need for us to sort of stay on top of our game in terms of reflection and interest in who we are and how we project our world. Because it is fascinating. If we go from the viewpoint that we are not bad people because we have these habitual patterns, but other people have habitual patterns just like we do, so if I can learn about mine, it's going to be a whole lot easier to learn about mine than to learn about yours or yours. But I can understand yours. So he says, the lack of attention to the psychological aspect of what is unfolding in our actions and observations causes us so much of the difficulty we experience in our lives. So when we don't pay attention to how we are, to what our motivations are, to what our intentions are, to how the world is responding to us, when we miss out on that, we're actually depriving ourselves of reality. And ignorance is not bliss in this particular religion. So the place to begin is some kind of vigilance, or even better, because vigilance sounds a little too like you're a vulture sort of over hanging over, waiting for you to screw up. It's more like I'm sorry.
Awareness.
How about interest or curiosity?
That's good.
Yeah.
That we are truly works of art. We are truly worthy. We are worthy of enlightenment. We are also, our minds are splendorous and manifold, so we may as well enjoy the show. And that's a good place to start. And from there, we begin to develop our intelligence. Now, Trollope Rinpoche talks about the fact that we sometimes objectify our worlds when we need to be sort of touched by them. We make something into an it very easily. We ignore others. But we also take things personally that are not about us. That happens a lot. Mm-hmm. And we're you know, it's very easy for us to get these things wrong because, you know, we are so self-involved. And part of the intelligence is sort of undoing the patterns that we have about taking things personally or about something else, somebody else being other, or not you, or not worthy of our attention. So we sort of ignore them. And so, by developing that kind of discernment, we allow ourselves to be touched by others in different ways. We expand the horizon of our capacity for love. But we also don't take everything so damn personally. And it becomes much easier to appreciate that there's cause and effect, and it doesn't have to be about whether I'm a worthy human being or whether people like me or any of that stuff that we spend so much of our mind projecting. I was thinking about the three baskets of the Buddha, three baskets of teachings. And we've been mostly talking about knowledge or wisdom or intelligence. But there are two more. One is called discipline. And by discipline, we're not here talking about rules and regulations, but we're talking about the fact that every day we make decisions, little ones, teeny ones, and we need to be aware of the decisions we make. Not to be obsessive-compulsive, not to be perfectionist, but, you know, look, for instance, those of us who have tried to lose weight know that every day has its temptations and every day has its little decision places. Same thing with other things in life. So discipline is simply an outgrowth of intelligence, of discerning what's beneficial, what's harmful, discerning when we are making excuses, and when we're giving ourselves a hard time just for being human, and we could like relax a little bit and appreciate who we are. So that's what I mean by discipline. And I know there are 275 rules for women and the Vinaya and stuff like that, but don't worry about that stuff. Unless like Miriam, you want to like take your hair off and become a nun.
What's the third basket?
I'm about to tell you.
Okay.
Oh, is what brought us together. Meditation. How does meditation fit in this? Meditation is what accelerates the process, both processes. Because meditation allows our mind to be exposed to ourselves. And for us to have to sort of sharpen loyalty to truth as opposed to whatever we convenient sort of fictions we like to make up. So meditation is a definitely strikes in the area of self-honesty. Because it's hard to hide when we're meditating. We can fall asleep, we can sort of fantasize, but we know we're doing it. You say, okay, I'm avoiding. All right. Why don't I just like find my breath and like get going here? I know I'm breathing. I'm
that
not choking. What's that?
That rang a bell.
Tonight.
But also, it allows us what we call an appreciation of space. The space between our thoughts and our intentions and our actions. We can begin to look at the world in a little more of a wide lens and see that how we're interconnected and how it's not... and how the world is much more wonderful than we ever imagined it would be. So, it's probably pretty easy to know whether you're making progress. You know, we're not talking about becoming Buddhas, although that would be lovely, and you know, I prostrate to any of you who you know decide to like sort of do that thing. But generally speaking, we make progress, meaning we are replacing negative karma with positive karma because our minds are more open, we see more things, our behavior, our minds are more flexible, we see alternatives. So instead of going down the same well-worn path, we actually see that there are several paths. There are different possibilities. We could try something we haven't tried before. Why not? I know my usual thing doesn't work. Let's try something else. Secondly, as we develop flexibility, we become more skillful. And toward the end of the chapter, Trayog Rinpoche talks about skillful means. Because we're not reduced to, you know, one hammer and one nail attitude toward life, we find that the things we do have results that are positive. We find that we're actually being of help to people, which is a wonderful realization when it happens. It's like, oh, wow, I was actually useful there. How'd that happen? I was thinking during some of the days of my wayward youth, after Brandeis, but I was different place involved in. And I was doing my drinking and drug thing, and I remember not so fondly, you know, like walking around and people who know me sort of, and thinking, these people think I'm a total asshole, don't they? And it was sort of bruising. And I'm sure they didn't because I'm not that important. But there's a certain kind of sort of thing you get from people that's a result of what you're putting out to people. And imagine that going the other way. It's like, oh, people like it when I walk into a room. I'm actually like, you know, part of the solution, not the problem. And that's sort of what skillfulness, how skillfulness becomes. And so we're not transcending anything. We're not all wise or omniscient or anything like that. And I think we've all experienced this, or we wouldn't keep coming back here and trying to meditate and trying to live and have our minds a little more spacious and our activity a little less self-regimented. So, okay. Sermon over. Questions, thoughts?
Please. I was thinking about when I was teaching that I had trouble with the class, and I realized I was very attached to what I wanted to happen. And I was so attached to that, and when it didn't happen, being unhappy with the students because they weren't behaving.
They were not cooperating.
They weren't doing. They weren't being who I wanted them to be. And I finally realized that, in fact, what I needed to do was be much stricter with them. That not having this sort of very clear boundaries was hard for them. I thought it was being nice, and I liked to do it that way, and that made me feel good about myself because I'm friendly and I'm not restrictive. And it was very interesting to finally realize, like, oh, well, that was about me liking it. It wasn't about me helping the other person. And how often we do that. We're like, I'm going to be the way I like, and that will help everybody. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't, because everybody doesn't need what I like.
And,
you know?
And there's like a self-protective thing about that which always fails.
Yeah.
By, you know, this is the way it's going to be. I've seen a lot of bad teachers do that. And they keep on doing that, and they blame the students for like not getting it.
I think maybe that's what he meant when he was arguing against the theistic view of that there should be set ways that are right as opposed to what's correct or helpful in the particular situation. So you had kids that maybe needed discipline. You like to think of yourself as this loosey-goosey type. But that's not what they
need. But she was loosey-goosey, but she was also really controlling.
Right. Well, I wanted to be controlling in that environment.
Right.
I wanted my, you know, good nature to control the thing, which is like, didn't work.
This is it's a wonderful example of the mixed intentions that we have.
Yeah. You know, and I actually brought it to this other meditation group I go to, and this one woman said, I work with kids like that. And sometimes they need you to hold them because they feel so unsafe.
Yeah.
They
yeah.
need that, like, this is the way it has to go. I was like, oh, so that would actually be kinder than what I think is kind.
Yep.
But it could vary from semester to semester. Also, I taught for a long time, and one group's collective consciousness could... You almost have to, like, start to try to feel what direction to go in, because it varies. You can have a completely different group next semester, and the approach that I discovered that finally worked today could, you'd be starting
well,
all
even
over
with
again.
The same group of kids.
And if you hold on to one version of who you are, you won't be able to make the change.
Right. That's or even one version of who the other people are. Like, they should show up and be the same every day, and then what I want to do will work. Like,
have you ever noticed that sentient beings are really oppositional?
Yeah.
They do whatever they damn well want to do.
And
they
it gets
don't
more
care.
Complicated with groups.
Especially. Yeah. Others. You ready?
That's the way we learn the ethics. So that's the comes the ethics, right, if I'm not wrong. So this other example which I'm trying to focus on, this is the person who is the vegetarian, who are a veggie guy. They feel that the person who is the non-veg, they are not ethics.
Mm.
Right? So so we need to understand that's the reason behind when we talk about the ethics, we talk about they are good in their region. We should understand that they are good in their scope. And what we are doing, that is our scope. So,
ever notice how everybody thinks of themselves as a good person?
Right.
Even when they're pretty damn not good.
Right.
We will, because of this and that, and if this person didn't do that, and but I'm actually really a good person. Why am I, you know, in jail or whatever? And it has to do with the sort of universal nature of our sense of morality or ethics. We all think of ourselves as good people. And people who don't do that, we tend to, they have a deficit. They have a problem. So it's 9 o'clock.
Pretty close. Huh?
Chris, did you have a question? You have, your face sort of looks...
No.
Cool. Oh, okay.
No,
you're
no,
thinking.
No, I'm thinking.
Okay.
Thinking is good. I'll be back in 2 weeks to you know, for more fun and games. So is there anything that... Sometimes when you leave a room, you say, yeah, I wanted to say blah, 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 and I didn't. Any of...
Lisa and I were looking at each other. I don't think that everybody thinks they're a good person or feels all the time that they're a good person, but we do think from our perspective. So
of course,
to say to think the other person is wrong. I mean, you may feel like a rotten person, but then someone does something and you're still seeing it from your perspective.
Yes.
So it's more that you know, I'd say it's more that people think that they're right. And the other people.
Okay.
Maybe.
I'll go with
not
that.
Right.
That's fine.
It doesn't mesh.
But it's the same kind of thinking.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
that is involved with our moral assessments that we make all
right.
the time. Mm-hmm. So I don't, you know, I hope this inspires you to investigate yourselves. You don't have to read Aristotle or Kant.
Don't worry, we won't.
Don't worry. But you
might. For that.
They're great.
You know what? We'll have another lifetime to do that.
Next lifetime, you'll come back.
Emily and Roberta and I will be born on a different day.
We'll be philosophy professors. It's the April 29th. People just don't get this stuff. That's the way. Just as an astrologer, so they'll understand where we come from.
It must be that seventh degree of Taurus or something.
Taurus people.
Okay. Let's end.